Thank you, Joanne. It's great to be here. Thank you for coming out on a Tuesday evening to hear a talk, whatever you've been doing all day. I hope I'll make it worth your while coming along. And thank you for the great spread we had. I managed to fit a few sandwiches in on the before I started. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the project that I'm working on just now. I'm going to tell you how we arrived at doing it, tell you a bit of a story, and I'm going to give you some of the examples of the sort of scientific and faith things that we're working on. So, can I do my slide? Ah, thanks. Magic. So, I'll tell you, well, you've heard about what I do. I'll tell you a little bit why. There I am in my red jumper on a pier in Scotland. I actually got this photo off Facebook. A friend sent it to me. They're not all my brothers and sisters. There I am in my red jumper, little Yud. And, you know, as a child, we all start out curious. And I think for a scientist, you kind of get a job carrying on being curious. You don't really have to grow up. You can keep asking why, what for, what's inside, only it's not your mum you're asking anymore. It's your experimental technique. So I carried on my own research, was on zebrafish. This is the head end of a zebrafish baby, a zebrafish larva. And I was studying their eyes, those great big sort of brown, beautiful brown eyes, although they're more kind of golden shimmery under the microscope. I was studying eye development, and zebrafish are great because they develop, you know, they're not developing in the womb, you can see them, and you can even order zebrafish from other labs with, you know, I had some where the lenses glowed green in UV light, which is very handy when you watch them develop. I'm not going to talk to you this evening about zebrafish development. I wasn't organized enough to print out the notes that come with my slides, so I'm just clicking them along at the same time. I'm here to talk about my work in science and faith. I found myself not patient enough to work in the lab full time, so I started work. I wanted to work in science communication, but then I saw a job advertised with Christians in Science, which this group is a part of. If you're not a member, you really should be. If you're a scientist, you have a scientific background, or you're very interested in this kind of thing, it's not very expensive, and you get lots of literature and conferences and support as you think about science and faith. So I had great fun working for them, and I began to answer some of the questions I had when I was studying science. I was in a very privileged position of being able to get the answers from the horse's mouth and became very passionate about trying to communicate things about science and faith to people. So when the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion was set up by a couple of members of Christians in Science in St. Edmund's College, one of the Cambridge University colleges, so there's no official link with Christians in Science, but some of the same people are involved. When the Faraday Institute started up, I was working part-time for Christians in Science. I said, have you got another part-time job going? And for a while I worked for both. And I came on board at the Faraday Institute to develop resources for churches and to serve churches with helpful information about science and faith. So this is my job. Unlike all your other speakers who are giving up their spare time to be here, this is my job, and I'm going to have a lie-in tomorrow in return. So you don't need to feel sorry for me traveling back to Cambridge tonight. There's my church, so that's kind of the context. This is the context of where I work. And I do serve my own church with my work as well. I'm delighted to be able to do that. And as has been mentioned, the first project I did was the Test of Faith, and I do have a couple of the items, book and DVD, here. There are a whole load of other things, there's study material and things. The reason I'm advertising my own stuff is because I wanted to say the first thing I started with at Faraday was the issues and the debates, so the creation and evolution and the bioethics and the conflict and the Richard Dawkins and the things that probably you've had lots of talks about. But then and that was very important, I think, to do. I'm very glad I did it. But during that project, I heard somebody called Alistair McGrath, theologian. I'd heard this message from lots of people, but this was the first time when I thought, this could affect my work, where he said, Christians, scientists, need to see themselves as being called to their place of work. They need to rise up and be able to speak about faith in those areas, showing how faith enriches their science. So not just talking about the debates was part of what he was saying. We do need to get involved in the debates, but we also need to talk about the positive stuff. Go out on the front foot, so to speak, because at Faraday, certainly, we get phoned up every now and then. Do you want to respond to this? Have you got a scientist to go head-to-head with so-and-so on the Sunday program, you know, or whatever? And nobody ever phones us up saying, so, science and faith, what's cool? You know, tell us anything exciting, you know? You never, ever get those opportunities. So if you want to have a more positive conversation, you have to start it. So I thought, okay, so that was the reason. I advertised my books right at the beginning. Get it over and done with. That was why I did the God in the Lab project and the blog, started the blog. Very privileged to have lots of great guest authors as well as writing myself. Really just trying to talk about the beauty, the creativity, the imaginative processes, all the things that go on the human side of science, sort of to clinicalize science in a way and say it's a human process and there is a lot in common with everyday life. You know, you're either enjoying your work for different reasons, you're doing it for different reasons, and it's interacting with your faith in different ways. So trying to build bridges for people and to build bridges with faith, because faith is similarly, you know, our creative imaginative process where you do feel awe and wonder. So trying to build that in. So what I'm doing now with the Wonders of the Living World project is really just to carry on that conversation and say, well, you know, you've had the speakers on the issues, and that's very, very important. But in a sense, it's firefighting, you know. And those people, I know some of the people, Keith Fox is going to come speak this next week, and I know those speakers would say, yes, you know, this is very important that they're talking about creation or evolution or ethics or whatever, but they'd wish they could just tell you about how exciting their research was and how it feeds into their faith. So I've decided to make it my mission, if you like, to do that. So I don't say yes to people ask me to speak about evolution, and I say no. I'm the one person in Faraday who doesn't talk about it because I want to set the positive agenda for the churches. So what we're trying to do with the project, I'm sorry, the writing's, it looks very small on my screen. Big on you, so communicating the wonders of creation. So the title, The Wonders of the Living World, which people tend to say, quite a lot of people have said to me, it sounds a bit like David Attenborough. And I say, exactly. That's the whole point, is to try and say, well, yes, we're going to do wonders. We're going to do them in a Christian context. And then also to hear from Christian scientists and the positive questions their faith is making them ask about their science, the questions about meaning and purpose that science raises. And I will give you three examples of how that happens later. I want to put forward a cautious form of what I would call natural theology. And I will explain what natural theology is in a minute, but a lot of what is done in science and religion, or science and Christianity, is natural theology. And I want to, as I said, start those new conversations. So that's what I've been working on. I've just finished the manuscript of a book a couple of days ago. I'm tired, but I'm full of it. I'm very excited about it. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So I'm going to start off with a quick scientific story, just to get your awe and wonder juices going. Then I'm going to talk a bit about theology, natural theology, And then I'll give you three examples of the science I'm working on. So hopefully this will give you things that as you go away and people say, what did you do yesterday? Or certainly in our discussion here just now, then you can say, well, I heard this stuff and it made me think of X or Y, or I never even thought of that question, or it got me excited about this in a different way. So that's what I'm hoping will happen. I'm going to give up on my notes on my computer. my slides are not in sync. So you must probably know that all living things are made of cells. They are the building blocks of everything, so small you can't see them unless it's an egg. They're large enough cells to see. I won't crack you an egg, as my developmental biologist friend does. He is a cell. This is a plant. This is a cross-section of a plant. But inside every cell, pretty much every cell of your body, is DNA. That is the instructions for building each cell and how each cell interacts with each other, what their properties are, and how they do. And you're probably very familiar with the DNA helix, even if you may not understand that much about its properties. You'll have seen it in sculptures, stained glass windows, maybe even all over the place. This is the original figure from Watson and Crick's 1950-something paper. And I was just talking to someone who did this technique, X-ray crystallography, very difficult technique to try and come up with the structure of DNA. And essentially, this was mathematically worked out. It wasn't exactly a theory, but it wasn't something that people had seen this, this beautiful helix, until a few years ago, when with an atomic force microscope, there it is. Sorry, it's very small and fuzzy, but you can just see the way it's curling around. If you're very observant, you'll notice it's curling around in the opposite direction to the natural DNA. That's because DNA comes in left and right-handed helices. And the DNA in our bodies tends to form a right-handed helix. For some reason, these people with their atomic force microscope chose to publish a picture of a left-handed helix. I was very tempted to flip it around so that it matched the picture, but I didn't. There's integrity for you. Anyway, they're waffling on, but I was very, very excited to see that helix. And the amazing thing is, you had to use this atomic force microscope so it can see a single atom, pretty much, to see DNA. It's that thin. It's so thin that you can fit 2 meters of it inside a cell. it's wrapped up literally like thread on a bobbin. That's wrapped round and round, sort of series of beads, to pack it down into the cell. 2 meters of something you couldn't see if I was dangling a molecule. Well, that would be impossible, it would break. But anyway, you'd be able to see it. And just to take that a little bit further, so you've got 2 meters of DNA in every cell in your body, that's quite a long piece of DNA. If you took it all out and added it end to end, I was told it would go to the moon and back, which sounds quite incredible. It's actually wrong. I discovered it was wrong because I looked it up, because I thought, that's such a good little factoid. I want to repeat it, but I thought, I'll be responsible, I'll check it. And it's very, very wrong. And we'll see how wrong it is if we do the maths. Here we go. How many cells are there in a human body? Now, this is the most difficult thing to do. The best way to find this out would be to take a person, dissolve them, so you separate all their cells from each other. And well, that's difficult because some of them are fused. But anyway, put them through a cell sorter and count. Now, that's dangerous and illegal and terrible. We won't do that. But we could come up with estimates. Can anyone, just for fun, how many cells, guess, do you think are in your body? 10 to the 20th. 50 trillion, with 12 zeros, 50,000 British billions. American billions are smaller than ours. It's the only American thing that's smaller than a British one, I think. 50 trillion, roughly. within somewhere between 10 and 100 trillion, so 50 is kind of in the middle. Depends how big you are. So multiply that by 2 meters. I'm sorry, we're metric. So you can do the maths. Is about 100 trillion meters or 100 billion kilometers. 100 British billions, 9 zeros. I can't get my head around a number that big. But anyway, so how far is it to the moon? Anyone know in kilometers? Someone always knows. 300,000. Yes. Well done. Yeah, 380,000 kilometers. So the to the moon and back was so, so deeply wrong because it was too small an estimate. Okay. So let's go a bit further. How far is it to the sun? Yeah, so let's convert it into kilometres. 150 million kilometres. Conveniently, round number is used as an astronomical unit. So how many times can we go to the sun and back? 100 billion into 150 million divided by 2. Anyone want to hazard a... It's too late, and you haven't had enough sandwiches. Or you've had too many. 333 round trips. There we go. That's how much DNA is in your body. Those are the instructions that are needed to build your body and keep you alive every second of every day. All sorts of things are happening every second of the day. I won't confuse you even further by telling you all of them. I do have a Bible verse written down here, is in harmony with what I believe. And in the book of Job, one of Job's friends, when he talks about some natural things early on in the book of Job, and these are but the outer fringe of God's works. How faint the whisper we hear of him. Who then can understand the thunder of his power? Great poetry describing God's power. And I think those two things are in complete harmony. So I think science and faith fit together a little bit like this. If my life is a Venn diagram, you can tell I'm a scientist, can't you? This isn't to scale at all. I hope. Sometimes it feels like it is. So there are all sorts of things. My Christian faith is the background to the whole of my life, is the big circle. And there are all these things I do specifically as part of my Christian life. And then when I was working in the lab, I did these things. There were things that I did in science. Things that I would probably largely only do in science. Things like experiments. Reducing things down to their components to find out how they work. Getting excited about data. And some of those things I would not do outside of the lab. So if I visited a friend with cancer in hospital, I wouldn't be excited about the science behind their cancer. That would be utterly inappropriate. I might try and help them and explain things, but I wouldn't be like, oh, have you got that mutation? Wow, I wonder what that means. Nobody's mapped that yet, you know, whatever. You know, you don't do that. Likewise, I wouldn't pray in the lab for a certain result in my experiment. That would be completely ridiculous. Who am I to tell God what to do, how he should have made the universe? My job is to, I could pray I do my experiment well. So there are some things that overlap my behavior, I think it goes with me into the lab, my ethics, when I was working in the lab, but there's some things that I would definitely do in the lab, some things that definitely wouldn't, but it's all within my Christian faith. This is because theology, my clicker's not working completely, there we go, thank you. Theology fed into the development of science in the West. So the idea that God's creation was good, the idea that God's world is ordered and useful. I mean, it talks about the cycles of the moon and the seasons, and this is part of God's providence, that we can understand and use things. We're commanded by God to go out into the earth and to subdue it responsibly. And the idea that understanding involves research, So this is, some Greek philosophers would think that you can sit in your armchair and reason about how the world should be from first principles, which doesn't make sense to us anymore because we live in a scientific culture. But certainly Christians justified doing science in this country by saying, we don't know how God created, we have to go and find out. So that was certainly a justification for doing science. So you can come up with a theology of science. I've got a picture of Michael Faraday here because I am at the Faraday Institute, and I've got a quote from him where he said, the book of nature, which we have to read, is written by the finger of God. So his belief was that we are studying what God does, what God made. And then taking that forward, there's the idea that scientific knowledge can lead to worship. And this is certainly what I find speaking to scientists, that if they are engaging with their science and their faith together and not putting them in separate compartments, they're doing their work and they're thinking, God, how great thou art, you know, kind of thing. You know, the great hymns, kind of, you can just pour into them from looking at what you know about science. And then, very obviously, there's the practical value of science. Oh, too far. Anyway, there's the practical value of what we do in trying to serve God and serve people. We use scientific knowledge. So you can have a good theology of science. So this is the positive side of science. I find that people sometimes sort of ask me, oh, it must have been really hard being a Christian in the lab. And I think, well, actually, no, it was great. I mean, yeah, it was tough, you know, it was hard work, but there's nothing to feel sorry about me for. So we can go into natural theology, which is really what I've been looking at in this project, and thinking of, and this is again from Alistair McGrath, thinking of theology as a lens that you can, if you're looking out at the world through the lens of theology, does what you see make sense? So this was a good way of doing it, rather than good looking at the world through whatever other lens you happen to be or have over your eyes, and saying, "Well, is there evidence for God?" You know, it's more saying, "Does our theology make sense of science?" It's not, we're not thinking about proof or evidence for God, but thinking about whether a science and faith makes sense together. Is science consistent with belief in a loving, purposeful creator? So those are some of the stories I'm going to talk about in a minute. And then also looking beyond the limits of science. So we can see whether our faith makes sense with the science, but then there are going to be lots of things that science cannot answer, that we have to look beyond the edges of science. Faith will prompt us to ask questions that science cannot answer. So we need to be willing to look beyond science for some of those answers. So I'm not doing a talk. None of the examples I give, I'm giving as proof or evidence for God. Because often people at the end are like, that's rubbish proof for God. I'm like, yeah, but I never, that's not what I was trying to say. It's going to give you just a few examples of, maybe a couple, of examples of science that is raising questions, that's helping people to worship. So the first one, I want to introduce you to Professor Jeff Hardin, who's a developmental biologist. This is a human embryo, of course. He has had kids. This is not his kid. I got it off the internet. But he actually works on worms, which someone's going to show us a video of the worm moving. This is not in real time. This is speeded up. They don't move this fast. They're like this big, a couple of millimeters long. And you can see right through their bodies. They're completely transparent. And he thinks they're very beautiful. You can see there's its gut, whole thing, and its tail. And it's small, it's cheap to keep, and you can see it developing very easily. So it's a good organism to work on if you want to study development. But obviously he... Oh! Can we go back to the PowerPoint? Is that? Thank you. Jeff teaches also about human development. And I read a book about human development that was called Life Unfolding, and I thought it was a beautiful book, but I hated the title because life does not unfold, it folds up. You can kind of see it from these pictures. You've got more and more folds and forms and things, you know, coming along in the embryo. So it's a little bit like origami. And this is a hand forming. This is kind of like the end of the origami model when you're beginning to pull a section out. You know, this hand bud comes out. And then you need to get your scissors out, maybe a little bit, or do some more folds to make the fingers, get rid of those webbed flaps that make the fingers. So it's kind of like origami, making a human. And he talks about the dance of the cells, because the cells themselves have the instructions within them and are interacting together and giving signals together as they fold over each other and they fold in and they move around, you know, and they're moving in and under, you know, all these movements happening as these cells, which are attached together in sheets and holding on to each other, are moving round and in and round each other. So it's this beautifully choreographed dance, like an origami. I didn't attempt to show you a video off YouTube. I wasn't sure that would work. But as you watch someone build an origami model on, you know, in a sort of speeded up, it can look kind of like a dance. And there's a very obvious link with the Bible here, and Jeff uses this verse a lot with his students. It's a secular biology class, but he says this at the beginning just to get them excited. He said, well, some ancient Hebrew poetry, you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. There's another metaphor. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And he wants them. He says, I don't know what you believe. This has nothing to do with what you believe, but the wonder I want you to experience. And he finds for himself the questions that his biology raises. He's losing, in a sense, the mystery of what goes on in the womb during development, but his sense of wonder is being fed with new stuff. You know, he's learning about all these processes that nobody knew about before. These very fragile beginnings, this very fragile process, it seems to work again and again and again and again, but we can be very humble about our beginnings. And you could ask questions about our significance. Obviously, for Jeff, he is a Christian. His questions about his significance and his humble beginnings are answered by his faith. And it makes him want to worship. But obviously, for him, the most incredible thought as a Christian is that God went through this process in becoming human. He submitted to being an embryo. And to communicate this, Jeff chose this poem. Biologists can also be creative. My clicker's failing me sometimes, but someone very helpful is advancing the slides for me. Thank you very much. He chose this poem. After the bright beam of Annunciation fused heaven with dark earth, his searing, sharply focused light went out for a while, eclipsed in amniotic gloom, his cool immensity of splendor, his universal grace, small folded in a warm, dim female space. That's quite a thought. God is surprising and does things in a way that we would never have planned. So those are Jeff's thoughts that his faith raises about his science, which I think are very fascinating. And something that I think we can all identify with, particularly if you've had kids. So I'll move on to another topic, just briefly. Something that you may also be able to identify with. Has anyone been snorkeling or diving? Lots of people. Or certainly seen the David Attenborough series, maybe, about coral reefs. This is Margaret Miller, who's a marine biologist. These people always frustrate me by sending me mugshots of themselves looking kind of, you know, cool and outdoorsy in wetsuits. The rest of us, you know, have been there in our white coats, boring, burrowing away in a lab. But so she spends a lot of her professional life, or as much as she can, with a dive mask on down in the sea. And we use the metaphor living cities to describe this topic for a coral reef, because it's kind of like a busy city. You know, you've got all these different creatures, all these different ecosystem services going on. You've got, you know, exchange of food and jostling for space. You need waste disposal you need fresh water coming in. So it's one way of looking at an ecosystem. These sort of living cities under the sea. And actually, about a sixth of the species, I think over a million of the species on Earth, live on or around coral reefs. So it's a very important place. And Margaret studies this coral, sort of orangey coral, it's huge, that was responsible for building most of the reefs in that big bay around Florida and Cuba and the Gulf of Mexico and the Bahamas. So this is a very important species. And it's amazing how it was built. I do apologise if you've seen all this on David Attenborough, but I thought it was absolutely incredible that each coral, hard coral, is made up of thousands of tiny little polyps. They look like sea anemones to me. They're probably related. I should check that. And they, inside them, so they feed by putting out these tiny little stinging darts, catching plankton. But their main food source is, there's a picture of a couple of polyps, and you can see the brown blobs inside them, and they are algae that live inside the coral. So it's a symbiosis. They're working together. And here's a picture of the algae. And the algae get a nice, warm, safe place to live. They get provided with the waste products from the coral, and they give back nutrients that the coral can eat. So they're photosynthesizing like plants, and they're making carbohydrates that the coral can use. So it's a really nice system. And it works very well unless things go wrong. And that's what Margaret's work is on. So she's doing these incredible techniques. Here's one of the techniques that she and her colleagues use. They do coral gardening. So they take cuttings. Well, they find bits that have been broken off, break them up into smaller bits, and kind of grow them as cuttings on the seabed, attached to lumps of concrete. And then they take those lumps of concrete, once they've grown, and they put them back on coral reefs. Because coral grows so slowly. If you just left it alone, if a reef had been destroyed, if you just left it alone, it would be hundreds of years before it kind of reformed. So you have to give it some help along. So they do this coral gardening, like I do with my geraniums, if I'm organized enough. But then she also does coral midwifery, because these are cuttings, all right? And if everything is identical genetically, because you've taken cuttings, the minute you get a disease, like the tomatoes in Nigeria this year, they're gone. Okay. So they need genetic diversity, so they also do coral midwifery. When the coral's unhealthy, it can't reproduce properly. So they go out collecting. Here she is with her collecting bag, collecting the spawn from the coral, then they take it back to the lab. They carefully pick out the fertilized eggs and they grow them. And then I think they look little, really cute, like little flowers. Here it is. The pink bit is a lump of concrete or rock that the coral baby is growing on. And then they transplant them out onto the reef. And they're trying to find ways of helping them to survive. So these are new, genetically diverse coral babies. So it's incredible the work she's doing. I think these are wonderful stories of science. But she, her own reflections, and that what her, here's another nice coral picture. This is actually the Maldives. Sorry, my assistant worked in the Maldives, so it's a good source of pictures. She's a marine biologist. It's not Florida. The questions that Margaret is asking based on her work are things like, she's feeling, again, like Jeff, very humble, because coral reefs, as I said, more than a million species centered around reefs. She's thinking, we're trying to help, but we don't completely understand what's going on. They're doing as much research as they can so that they can do good and not harm. But she's feeling very humbled by the size of the task, the scale and complexity of the things that she's trying to help. She's also got to figure out why she's doing this, and this is a very, very live question in ecology, is why do we bother conserving things? Why not just let the world muddle through? You know, okay, we're causing mass extinction, okay, the climate's changing, whatever, but surely things will just adapt. You could say that. and say, well, you know, we might lose a few million people on the way, or a few billion, but, you know, we'll adapt, it'll be fine. You know, we'll come out the end of it with a healthier ecosystem. And obviously nobody's saying that. They're saying, no, we need to value coral reefs, we need to value rainforests, these places where there's a huge amount of biodiversity. But people don't always have a basis for saying why. And certainly in the conversation about conservation, people are realizing that it's important to bring theologians along, certainly at least to represent huge portions of the world who believe in God in different ways. For her, obviously, she as a Christian believes that the value of these things is that all creation is praising God. That's the biblical message. That is the ultimate purpose of everything. And if we are damaging things so they cannot praise God anymore, you know, then what's the point? So, and also there's the idea that God values and has a purpose for the world, and a future purpose for the world, for it to be restored, and we can be part of that. So these are also very interesting questions, I think. Have I got time for one more scientific story? Is that all right? Okay, good. So those were hopefully quite fun and quite easy to identify with. Another one which is a bit more heavily scientific, The Struggle for Existence. I like the title. I got it from someone else. I didn't make it up myself. We hear about the struggle for existence. What about the struggle? So I'll tell you about that. This is lichen. I took this picture in Scotland where it's nice and clean, and I think there's a good, I don't know, 4 or 5 species of lichen living on this branch. I'm not a lichenologist. But it was a long time before people actually realised that lichen is not a single species. There are about 15,000 kinds of lichen catalogued, but somewhere in the 19th century, people realised that the way this was acting and reproducing, this is more than one organism here. This is two. And actually, Beatrix Potter was a great supporter of this theory. She was also a lichenologist and studied fungi and lichen in all her spare time in between writing best-selling children's books. She actually submitted a paper to the Linnaean Society that was never actually published. I think it might have been published eventually. But you can see, do look online if you get a chance and see her beautiful drawings of lichen. But anyway, inside lichen, the outside is a fungus, the inside is algae. Hopefully lots of you knew that already. It's kind of another fun factoid. So lichen can live pretty much anywhere where there is air, a bit of warmth from time to time, a bit of moisture from time to time, sunlight, and a hard surface for it to grow on. So the Arctic, you know, wherever. So the fungi protect the algae from drying out, and the algae, like the same in the coral, can provide nutrients. And this is the first example that was ever found of organisms living together, cooperating, in a sense. It's not a conscious choice that the organisms were made, but it was the first example of cooperation. It took about 50 years to be accepted because people found it so surprising. And then decades later, Jeff Schloss, who's a biologist and also a philosopher, interestingly, he's done both, mainly philosophy these days, but he started out in biology. He studied lichen for a while, and he loves asking questions that are letting science raise questions for theology, letting theology raise questions for science. And one of them is about cooperation. And he was very quick to point out to me when I spoke to him how that cooperation is embedded deep within every one of us. So here is a picture of a cell, or a cartoon of a cell. We have no blue cells in our bodies, as far as I know. But you can see all these little pockets and things inside it, which are important for its functioning. And these green things, which are not green in real life, the mitochondria, they're the energy centers of the cell. When people were talking about three-parent babies, it was the mitochondria they were talking about because they contain DNA. They actually behave like little cells within a cell. They reproduce themselves and they have their own DNA. Then the theory goes that back in the day, when it was only bacteria on the earth, little bacteria climbed into or was engulfed by big bacteria, and they set up a partnership. It happened that the big bacteria, like the lichen, like the coral, provided a good, safe, warm home for the mitochondria, and the mitochondria provided, made energy for the big bacteria. And they became so dependent on each other that they could never live apart. So it's like a reverse arms race. I don't know if anyone did biology around the era I did. We learned about the arms race of the pesticide resistance. So you have the plant, if you do any gardening, you know, you get a pest that eats your plant, you spray it, you know, and then, well, certainly for a farmer over decades, the pest may develop resistance to the spray. You have to find a different spray, or the plant itself, this was what I learned, the plant itself learns to be resistant to the pest, but then the pest overcomes that resistance and the plant has to learn another mechanism to get rid of the pest and so on. So it's kind of an arms race. But here it's kind of a reverse arms race of them becoming dependent on each other and helping each other. And that's happened right throughout the living kingdom. So here's an example of cells becoming more dependent on each other, individual cells. This is not a jellyfish. This is a Portuguese man of war. It's not a single organism. It's a loose collection of cells clustered together. Four different kinds, stinging kinds, eating kinds, floating kinds. I can't remember the other kind. And they're clustered together. They're doing their different things. They're dependent on each other, but they are born separately, and they have to come together. So it's an example of dependence developing. Sexual reproduction is another form of cooperation that, as I said, with the coral, it mixes the genes up. It makes for a healthier population. So it's another very important example of cooperation. Obviously, parenthood is a kind of an ultimate example of cooperation, taking different roles, taking it in turns to care for babies. And then you can have societies. So we have the cute meerkats. Not everything they do is cute, but they do exist as a society together, and they do take different roles. It's kind of a primitive society, if you like. We like to think, for more organized societies, where unrelated individuals work together. Very difficult to convince a zoologist that this is happening, because they want to see gene-driven behavior. You know, it's all about your genes and passing on your genes, but working in a group has got nothing to do with, you know, passing on your own genes. But it is about working together, and everyone can thrive together. What better place to say this than a church? We can see an example of that. It is controversial among behavioural zoologists, but it's very clear that it's happening to me, and certainly there are lots of different ways of proving that it is happening if you want actual empirical, measurable evidence. Now, for Jeff, the questions that this raises for him. One thing, actually, interestingly, I've given you my examples in a kind of a line: cells working together, sexual reproduction, societies, unrelated societies. There's kind of a continuum up. So he would say, in the progress of evolution, there has been an increase in dependence on each other at every stage. At every major transition from simple cells to complex cells, from individual cells to an organism, from individually reproducing organisms to sexually reproducing organisms, to societies, and so on, there's an increase in dependence. What is that compatible with? I'd like to ask you. The other one that he would say, because you're probably all thinking about it, what makes us different? Why are we kind to each other in groups? Why do we do that? Why would you help someone who's unrelated to you, even though they may give nothing back? No one may be watching. It may do you absolutely no good whatsoever. Why do we do that? And Jeff would say this behavior, altruistic behavior, self-giving behavior, comes from our spirituality. He would say that culture does affect us. Culture does affect our development. Culture does, he would say, affect the evolution of things. Again, that's a controversial thing to say. But some biologists do accept that. You know, these meerkats have a culture, and that's affecting the evolution of their society. But Jeff would say, if you can have culture, why shouldn't spirituality be in the mix there too? And he thinks there's good evidence that only humans do altruistic acts, and it's our spirituality that feeds into that. So those are the kinds of questions he's asking. Big, fat, controversial ones. It's kind of fun diving into the textbooks on this subject, but I did realise that this is quite deep waters, and there are quite strong discussions when there are zoologists in the room. I hope there are. I'd love to hear what you think. But we're in a Christian context here, so, and as I said in the beginning, the ultimate purpose of all of creation is to praise God. That's what the Bible says. So the last kind of words, if you like, is let everything that has breath praise the Lord. Everything is doing its thing by being itself, praising God. And we, with our conscious minds, can praise God more consciously. So those are the kinds of things I'm trying to raise. It's kind of a new thing to do. Lots of people do it in bits and pieces, but trying to focus on it entirely feels quite new and different. So I'd love to hear what you think. I'd love to hear what confused you, what inspired you, what questions it has raised. Here are some things one could think about. If embryos develop through this sort of choreography, beautiful choreography, if an ecosystem is this sort of valuable interwoven thing, if cooperation is completely central to the living world, what worldview is that data most compatible with? What do you think? I expect we are not all Christians here, and I expect there are people with a range of different views. What questions about meaning or purpose does it raise for you? So I've told you what the work, what the data raise for the scientists. What does it raise for you? We can talk about that. So I do need to say thank you to some people. This is Cara, my assistant. She's a marine biologist, but she has many talents. Has done lots of the research for this project. She's actually one of the few people in Faraday who does work in a lab at the same time as working with Faraday. So she's half-time in the zoology department, half-time with me. Obviously, the Faraday Institute is my base, and we're funded by the Templeton World Charity Foundation. I've already shamelessly advertised all my projects, not because I make money out of them, but because I think they're good resources for you. Scienceandbelief.org is kind of the umbrella for everything that we do for churches. And so I leave you with those questions and the web addresses, should you want to write them down, and we can discuss. So thank you for listening on a Tuesday evening. Thank you for listening, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. So.
Well, we have time for some questions. Can I take this out? Okay.
Don't
any questions?
Shy. If you've been wondering, probably everyone else has been wondering too. So about
right.
Something.
No questions? Gosh. It's the first time ever. Oh, we have some questions.
Thank you very much for your talk. Very interesting and beautifully illustrated.
Thank you very much. I mean, this brings a whole range of interesting thoughts and questions. I was intrigued this morning with Jim Al-Khalili's program on science, people in science. They interviewed the successor to Dawkins in the...
Oh, the mathematician.
That's right, who is a mathematician. Mm. And I was very interested that his view of mathematics is seeing what is possible, seeing all the things that are possible, and lots of things which are impossible, but sort of vaguely possible, possibly impossible.
Yeah.
The huge variety of mathematical thought.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you look at biology, I feel it's a bit like that. You know, anything that you could possibly imagine is out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful to behold, indeed. And I was interested to see that at the end of his talk, I'm sorry, this is more a comment, isn't it?
Rather, oh, no, please comment. It's fine, yeah.
At the end of his talk, he said, well, he said, what do you want to do next? He said, well, I need to promote public understanding of science, because that's a big thing, and I still need to carry on doing mathematics. But he said, I want to investigate what are the limits of mathematics, what are the limits of science.
Interesting, yeah.
And this whole area of biology, I mean, I'm a biologist, and I'm aware that when you do research, you're bumping up against things which you don't understand all the time. And that's great, because you believe that, you know, otherwise you'd be making it up yourself.
Yeah.
And when you look at the complexity of the world, it is an extraordinary world that we live in, certainly. If you have faith, certainly, you see that as an expression of something wonderful, which we, a person indeed, which we find it very difficult to find words to explain, but we use the term God, I suppose, to explain something inexplicable, or some person inexplicable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of the things that you talked about today, you know, are a bit sort of arguable, for instance.
Oh, yeah, they're all completely arguable.
Bacteria seem to manage quite well on their own. Not entirely, because apparently they do cooperate a bit as well.
But you don't get complex cells without the symbiosis, if you like.
Yes. My question to you, long last, is why do you think, you know, given this world, why is it so difficult for people to have a view that faith is real? If you look at Attenborough, he doesn't. I mean, he thinks it's a wonderful world, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is driving that? And why is it so difficult for people nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably always been difficult for people. I mean, Jesus found as long as he was handing out food and healing people followed him. But when it got difficult, a lot of people were like, you know, wow, didn't believe that much, you know, and he was left with a core of people, I think. I mean, God is a hidden God. We can't see him. He's not part of the fabric of the universe. We can't measure him scientifically. So we're left to rely on our spiritual experience to find God, to hear his whispers, if you like. And it seems that people are receptive in different ways. People may hear those whispers at certain times in their lives and choose to respond or ignore them. I think of one example of a friend who went to university. This isn't being recorded, is it?
No,
that's fine, so I can tell stories. He went to university and he said he knew there was a point. He wasn't exactly a Christian at that point, but he had experienced church, and he knew there was a point when he was standing next to a chap in his college, and he thought, I should befriend him, and life will be good. I can't remember exactly what he said. And he didn't, but he knew, looking back, if he'd befriended this guy, he just had a sense that life would have been a bit different, and this guy was a Christian. I'm not expressing it, I didn't kind of write the story down, but I thought it's that kind of little whisper that he just chose to ignore because he was too embarrassed to go and talk to him or something, or shake it off. But And obviously there's the more direct revelation in the Bible and the church, which can be sort of examined and filtered and sorted and, you know, very logically. And in the end, like any good relationship, you have to go, well, I'm never going to have 100% proof, but will you marry me? You know, I don't know if it's going to work, but I think it might, you know, kind of thing. But I think that's kind of my perspective on the sort of, the conundrum, if you like, as a scientist, I think.
Thank you very much for your lecture. You gave us some staggering, at the beginning, these staggering facts about DNA.
Yeah.
That was human
yes.
cells.
Yes.
What about single organisms?
DNA, bacteria don't have a lot of DNA, but they use it. Well, certainly viruses use their DNA remarkably efficiently. So And an example would be, there's one kind of virus, I've forgotten what kind it is, but I remember being told at university, and I was stunned, and I looked it up recently, and they still think it's like this, even though it's nearly 20 years later. But it, so DNA is a code, so it's like reading a book. But if you imagine, you know, if you have a paper shortage and you want to make the books more efficient, you could read it this way, and then you could turn it round and you could read it upside down, and then you could turn it sideways and read it sideways. Now, that would be impossible to write a book that you could read in three directions, but that's what the virus is doing. It's reading its DNA while it's kind of staggered. So I don't have to explain too much science to explain how it works, but it's reading, and essentially it's reading its DNA three ways, which I was just, that was a wow moment for me at university. You know, that's not quite what you asked, but I just thought of something amazing to explain. So, yeah, the bacteria and viruses, smaller cells, have much less DNA. Plants have more. So if you did, I should work it out, how the strawberry, or a strawberry field, you know, how much DNA that has to go to, it would go much farther than the sun, because plants generally have far, far more DNA. Plate on your food has more DNA than you. there's a thought. It's kind of fun. But obviously it's quality, not quantity, essentially. So you can have lots of DNA without it making you more clever. There's another question here, aren't we?
The title is the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, and it's called Science and Belief.
Yes.
Are you purely focused on the Christian faith, or you do take a world more worldview?
My job is Christian faith. Science and belief sounded snappy. Maybe I should have put Christian belief or something in there. But yeah, it is. Faraday Institute Science and Religion has a Christian ethos. So most of what we do is research on the major religion in our country. But we are open to other views. We do have people researching things like Islam. We have speakers on other faiths. So. That's how it works.
Taking up your theme of cooperation that you've asked us to think about, I think you've suggested that within DNA there's a certain amount of inbuilt cooperation to actually get things working. But once you get to the complete structure, the complete organism, whether it's an individual or a society, are you then arguing then that cooperation is more a matter of faith rather than of DNA?
Well, I think cooperation... is it part of the... Well, yeah, I guess genes are involved in evolution, so in a sense it is DNA that's involved in it. When it comes to society, I think I'm talking about group selection, essentially. So you have a group of unrelated individuals, they're coming together, their behaviours are emerging that are affecting them positively and helping them to survive. So in a sense, that is then feeding back, survival is feeding back into their genes. That's the argument. That's what's so controversial, is it's a kind of top-down effect. And it's messy. I mean, the minute you get people involved, it's messy, you know. It's not... That's why people don't like it, I think. Yeah. And it begins to touch very closely on who we are and how we tick, which brings, yeah, gets people jumpy if they disagree with your beliefs. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Ruth.